The Senate Committee on Business and Transportation for Thursday, Abe Lincoln Day.
Okay. Open up the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue on the same day.
So, Mazin, why don't you go ahead and get us started?
Chair Metzger and Chair Burdick, the meeting that we have today, the hearing with both committees, Transportation and Finance, is to receive about three reports. The first one would be the highway cost allocation study, and the second one is the flat fee study. And the third, finally, we would get the new forecast, the December forecast for revenue from the Department of Transportation. The first report, the highway cost allocation study, is a constitutional requirement. In the Oregon Constitution, you have in your packet, this is the Constitutional Article 19, Section 3A, where it requires that the Legislative Assembly shall provide for the biennial review and, if necessary, the adjustments of revenue sources to ensure fairness and proportionality of the highway dedication system, the highway revenue system. Also, on the back of that page, you would find the legal requirement, the statutes 366.506. That's where the highway cost allocation study is the process by which the compliance with the constitutional clause comes in. And in that section of the law, it does require DAS, the Department of Administrative Services, to be the delegated department to conduct that study. And then in number four, if you see, comes back and report the results of the study or the examination of the data shall be submitted to the Legislative Revenue Committees. That's both House and Senate, and the House side received it yesterday, and the legislative committees with primary responsibility for transportation by January 31st of each odd number years. You have, to my knowledge, received a letter of completion by that time, January 31st. Today, what you'll hear is the official report of that study. This study, of course, as I mentioned, by DAS, it was the Office of Economic Analysis. This is the Office of the State Economist who have conducted and oversaw the study. So Tom Pitowski, State Economist, is here to introduce to you the results and also to give you an idea, an overview of what they have done during that time. So with your permissions, Chair Metzger and Chair Burdick, he would come and start this process.
Good afternoon. Chair Metzger, Chair Burdick, members of the Senate Transportation Committee, and members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Tom Pitowski, State Economist with the Office of Economic Analysis, representing today to the Department of Administrative Services in our capacity as the overseer of the Highway Cost Allocation Study for 2009. As just said, we are the overseer of the study. Our role is to assure that the study is conducted in a scientific manner, that stakeholders have opportunities for input during this study period, and that the study findings are both transparent and reproducible for policy analysis. In response to a request for proposals, we hired a consultant. Eco Northwest was chosen to conduct the highway cost allocation study. In a moment, Carl Batten, who is the principal investigator from Eco Northwest, will be doing the overview for the study. Also, we had a project manager for the study, Brian Hedman, who's also here today from the CADMIS group. Brian coordinated meetings of our study review teams. They held the consultants' feet to the fire to make sure things were meeting deadlines throughout the study, and also took minutes and keeps the log of the minutes of all these meetings. We just want to reiterate, this study is definitely a collaborative effort of the group I've already mentioned, which is the Eco Northwest and the CADMUS group, and also our study review team, and also Department of Transportation, who is very instrumental in providing both data needs for the study to be completed and also expertise. So at this time, to give you a flavor of our study, I'd like to invite two of our study review team members to the table here to give you just a sense of what was accomplished and the process that was taken to do this particular study. And so I'd like to invite Bob Russell from the Oregon Trucking Association and also Professor Don Negri of Willamette University. Here, I can come back.
Okay. Welcome to the committees. Committees.
Chair Metzger and Chair Burdick. I'm Don Negri. I'm from Willamette University, and I was a member of the Oregon Highway Cost Allocation Study Review Team.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, members of the committees, my name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Association.
Well, I made a list of some of the activities that the study review team engaged in during the approximately year or 9 months or so that we were part of this process. We evaluated the initial proposal. We determined which issue papers were going to be conducted by the contractor. We discussed and approved the allocators and particularly discussed them when there was some ambiguity as to what they might be. We discussed and evaluated the model and the assumptions underlying the model. We asked the contractor to trace down what appeared to be anomalies in the results when it wasn't clear to us whether they were correct. We asked the contractor to provide more detail, more clarity, more transparency, and more transparency in the report and in the issue papers. We reviewed drafts of the reports. We asked the contractor to provide a model that was easily understood and could be worked by a non-expert, and to ensure it could be used for policy purposes. The SRT, the study review team, was also somewhat forward-looking in asking for the issue papers to look at the potential for cap and trade as a alternative method for road financing. We looked at the impact of climate change policy on how it would impact road policy. We looked at the potential for congestion pricing and other sorts of cost pricing, marginal cost pricing, to make more efficient use of our road system. And the bottom line from my perspective is that the final product from the contractor is improved. It's a better product. It's more user-friendly. It's more policy relevant. And it's more transparent because of the input of the study review team.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, I'm Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. You know, this is not the most scintillating topic that you're going to discuss this session. However, it is extremely important in terms of our transportation system. I've been doing this since 1983, and in 2000, we actually changed the Constitution and required the state to do a cost allocation study every 2 years and bring you the results, and then you're responsible to balance the books between trucks and cars to make sure everybody's paying their fair share, which is consistent with our user pay system. And it's the cost allocation that actually makes that work. This particular study was really interesting from my perspective because we're really starting to look forward at how we're going to change cost allocation to make it fit with the paradigms of the future. I mean, for example, you've already heard that the gas tax will have a lifespan and we won't be able to use it anymore because we're going to have cars that don't run on gas. We're going to have all kinds of things that we'll have to come up with a new method of financing our highways. Well, through the cost allocation study, we're already starting to look at ways that we can apportion those costs given those new types of tax instruments that we will be looking at in the future. We're also beginning to look at environmental issues and how we can incorporate those into our highway user system. You're going to hear at the end of the presentation about the efficient fee method of cost allocation, and I'll let Carl explain that to you in depth as it's been developed by Echo Northwest. But that's a piece of the proposal that will be in the transportation funding package as it comes across to you. That's one of the environmental pieces, actually, that will be there. So this group is doing a great job. Dr. Potowski is wonderful to work with, and we've done really good things, although it's like watching paint dry sometimes. So you may have some other questions as we get into the discussion about trucks and how all that works, and I would be happy to answer those questions at that time if they do arise.
Thank you.
Okay. Chairs and members of the committees, I would like to thank our study review team. They're basically the citizens, volunteers of their time. They got paid in some cookies and coffee, and that was about it. And they gave their expertise to us, which is, I think, a really good return for that public service. So I'd like to thank them. At this time, I'd like to invite Carl Batten up to the table to give the presentation and overview for the highway cost allocation study.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, Chair Metzger, and Senators. My name is Carl Batten. I'm with Echo Northwest, and we were the contractor who was the lead investigator for the highway cost allocation study. Highway cost allocation is something that was pioneered in Oregon. The first study in Oregon was in 1937, and this is the 16th study in Oregon so far. Since 1999, the state constitution has required a study every 2 years and has required the adjustment of revenue sources if found necessary. The question that the constitution asks is, are the shares of revenue paid by light and heavy vehicles fair and proportionate to their shares of costs? In Oregon, the highway cost allocation studies are administered by the Department of Administrative Services, Office of Economic Analysis, through Dr. Potowski. The contractor team this time around was Echo Northwest, along with HDR Engineers, Mark Ford, Jack Fawcett Associates, and Roger Mingo. HDR Engineers contributed specific expertise on bridges. Mark Ford helped with finance. Jack Fawcett Associates helped with several of the issue papers, including the one on carbon tax and cap and trade, and Roger Mingo is our pavements expert. Brian Hedman of the Cadmus Group served as the project manager, and ODOT staff provided data and technical assistance. The study review team you just heard about reviews the methods, data, and results, and discusses the issues. There were 11 different members on the study review team this time. Doug Anderson from Portland Metro, Doug Benson from the Idaho Department of Transportation, Mazen Malik from the Oregon Legislative Revenue Office, Mike MacArthur and John Oshel from the Association of Oregon Counties, Chris Monsier from the Portland State University, Tim Morgan from AAA Oregon, Don Negri from Willamette University, Tom Potowski, the chairman of the team, Bob Russell from the Oregon Trucking Associations, and Lorna Youngs from the Oregon Department of Transportation. So highway cost allocation asks the question, do various classes of highway users pay user fees in proportion to the costs they impose on the highway system? To answer that question, We need to define the classes of users we're interested in, allocate the costs to those user classes, attribute revenues to those user classes, and then compare the costs and the revenues. We do that by calculating what we call an equity ratio, which is the share of revenue, share of total revenues paid by each user class divided by the share of costs allocated to that user class. And if that equity ratio comes out close to 1.0, that means they're paying close to their fair share. If it's above 1.0, it means they're paying more than their fair share. And if it's less than 1.0, it means they're paying less than their fair share. Highway cost allocation can be done a variety of ways. In Oregon in particular, the costs to allocate are defined as the expenditures over the upcoming biennium. We include expenditures of federal funds because they're interchangeable with the expenditures of state funds. We include expenditures by local governments of state funds because the highway user fees, a portion of them are given to counties and cities to spend on local roads and streets. We also include the expenditures by local governments of federal funds for the same reasons as we do that at the state level. And we include some of their own source funds, those that we have determined are interchangeable with the state and federal funds. Some of the examples of local own source funds that we do not consider are interchangeable would be if a local government bonded to build a particular project, and those bonds were repaid through property taxes, and the funds raised were dedicated to that one particular project. We wouldn't count that because those funds are not interchangeable. They can't be spent on anything else, and we don't know how to attribute the repayment of property taxes to particular vehicle classes. Chapter 2 of the report you were given describes the structure of the study. Since the Oregon Transportation Investment Acts, bond financing has become much more important to highway finance in Oregon, and we've had to figure out how to allocate the costs of bond finance projects. What we do is we take the expenditure of bond revenues and look at how they're how those monies are expended in the upcoming biennium, and then we scale them down to the dollar amount that would be repaid during that biennium. So the amount of money, the total amount of dollars flowing out of the highway fund is made correct, but the shares of the expenditures is also tracked. And then we make a note of how we did that and carry those same expenditures into the next 9 studies, assuming a 20-year bond repayment schedule. There's additional detail in Chapter 3, and this picture here tries to lay out what we're doing. The dark blue box at the top is the expenditure of bond revenues in a particular biennium. The lighter blue boxes underneath are the repayment amounts over the 10 different biennia. And you can see that the size of the 10 smaller boxes is bigger than the original, and that's because there's interest included in each of those repayments. We take the dollar amount of one of those, allocate it out to the vehicle classes, and it goes into the study for that biennium, and we carry it forward to future studies. And then in the next biennium, same thing happens over again, and it all piles up into the future. In the current 2009 study, we've got expenditures of bond revenues from the 2003-2005, the 2005-2007, 2007-2009, and 2009-2011 biennia, all included. Oregon uses the incremental approach to allocating bridge costs. We look at what it would cost to build a bridge that could carry only basic vehicles, and the costs of that bridge are allocated to all vehicle classes. Then we look at how much more it would cost to build a bridge that could hold up to 50,000-pound vehicles, and that increment or difference in costs is allocated to all vehicles over 50,000 pounds, or over 10,000 pounds. And then we look at what it would cost to build a bridge to carry 80,000-pound vehicles, and that additional increment is allocated to all vehicles over 50,000 pounds, and so on. In Oregon, pavement wear and tear costs are allocated through the National Pavement Cost Model, which was developed by Roger Mingo for the Federal Highway Administration and used in the Federal Highway Cost Allocation Study. Roger adapted that model to Oregon, making use of the 2,000-pound weight increments that we use in Oregon and using actual data about the roads in Oregon. It's updated for each study with new vehicle miles traveled estimates and new information about the condition and structure of Oregon's roads. There's a complete list of allocators in Chapter 3 and Issue Paper 5, which is not attached to the copy you received today, but will be available when the report is put online, describes how all the allocators were chosen. In Oregon, we put a lot of effort into correctly treating alternative fee-paying vehicles. These are vehicles that pay a different rate schedule than what could be considered a normal vehicle. We call it a subsidy amount, even though it's not always a subsidy. It could be in some cases, they're paying more than they would if they paid the normal rate structure. We calculate that amount as the difference between what they do pay and what they would pay if they paid the regular fees. Then we add that subsidy amount up over all weight classes and allocate it out to full fee paying vehicles on the basis of full fee vehicle miles traveled. That's explained better in Chapter 3 of the report. The issue papers take a detailed look at issues that we thought were important in the current study. Some of the most important were the finance-related issues, including toll financing and public-private partnerships, debt financing and bond repayment, and congestion pricing. We took another look at the appropriate treatment of replacement bridges, and the issue there is if you build a new bridge to replace an old bridge, and the new bridge is different from the old bridge, how should you treat that? And if the old bridge was replaced before the end of its expected life, or if it was replaced before the end of its expected life, should you look at why it was replaced? And then we also took a look for the first time at carbon taxes and cap and trade and how they relate to highway cost allocation and highway finance. There's a total of 6 issue papers that will be available in the full report. The results of this study, looking at basic vehicles, which we define as all vehicles under 10,000 pounds. In the upcoming biennium, the basic vehicles are expected to travel 35.7 billion miles in Oregon per year, and 34.9 billion of those are expected to be by full fee-paying vehicles. They are expected to impose $1.26 billion in annual costs and to generate $568 million in annual user fees. They were attributed $16 million of the total subsidy. And altogether, the full fee paying basic vehicles were allocated $1.246 billion of costs and allocated subsidy, which is 67.1% of the total costs. Full fee paying vehicles paid 66.5% of the user fees, and the equity ratio comes out to 0.9915. which is close to 1.0. Heavy vehicles don't travel as many miles, expected to travel 2.8 billion miles in the upcoming biennium, and to impose $693 million in annual cost responsibility, to pay $301 million in user fees, and they get a $1.1 million share of the allocated subsidy, giving them $612 million in full fee cost plus allocated subsidy, which is 32.9% of the costs, and they'll be paying the full fee vehicles with paying 33.5% of the revenues for an equity ratio of 1.0173, which again is very close to 1.0. Within heavy vehicles, there are a variety of equity ratios when you look at the individual weight classes. They range from 0.47 to 1.55 for weight classes under 105,500 pounds. And some generalizations about those differences. Vehicles between 10,001 and 26,000 pounds are in general overpaying. Most vehicles between 26,001 and 78,000 pounds are underpaying. Vehicles between 78,001 and 80,000 pounds, which is 43% of heavy vehicle VMT, are overpaying. And then most vehicles above 80,000 pounds are underpaying. The full details for every weight class are available in Chapter 6 of the report you have. Our recommendations are in Chapter 7. No changes to rates are necessary for the light, heavy fairness and proportionality that's required by the Constitution. We do describe some revenue-neutral changes to rate structures that could improve equity within heavy vehicles. A flatter Table A rate structure, raising the rates for the lightest Table A vehicles and slightly lowering rates for the heaviest Table A vehicles would improve equity within the 26,001 to 80,000 pound range. Higher Table B rates would bring the over 80,000 pound vehicles more in line with their cost responsibility. And higher road use assessment fees would bring the very heaviest vehicles, the ones that carry non-divisible loads and can weigh as much as is allowed for the particular road they're traveling on. We also looked at flat fee rates that would match both the current and the recommended weight mile tax rates. The flat fee rates are paid by haulers of certain commodities who can pay by the month rather than by the mile. And the biggest difference there is that under the current rates, wood chips pay $24.62 per 100 pounds per year, and the what they would pay if they were paying the weight mile tax is considerably lower. Lorna Youngs with the Transportation Department will be telling you more about flat fee rates soon. The report you have in front of you has seven chapters: background, structure and parameters, method and approach, data and forecasts, expenditure and revenue allocation results, equity analysis, and recommendations. The appendices in the full report, which you'll be able to download soon, include a glossary of terms, the six issue papers, all of the meeting minutes from the study review team meetings, a model user guide for anyone who wants to make use of the model, which is publicly available, model documentation describing in detail how the model works, and then detailed inputs and results from the model run that was used to develop the final results presented in this report. Issues that we expect to be important in future studies are toll-financed facilities, especially those where the tolls are collected by a private entity to repay the investment made by the private entity in the facility. New revenue instruments that aren't part of current law, external costs, and how to deal with non-highway investments that are made to relieve congestion for highway users. A future opportunity that has a close relationship with highway cost allocation is the concept of efficient pricing. Efficient pricing is where you charge every vehicle exactly the right price based on when and where they're operating, how much they weigh, how much space they take up on the road. So each vehicle is charged exactly the right amount in proportion to the cost they're imposing on the system and on other vehicles, and the amount of revenue that's collected is the right amount of revenue so that if it's invested wisely, you get the right amount of new capacity and you get the right amount of preservation and maintenance. If efficient pricing were in place, you wouldn't need to do highway cost allocation studies anymore because everybody would be paying the right amount. How this relates to highway cost allocation is that one way to do highway cost allocation would be to pretend that people were paying the right amount and look at how much they did pay and then set your revenue instruments to collect in those proportions. The feasibility of doing efficient pricing is improving as technology advances. The on-vehicle GPS systems and axle scales are developed and working. You can have continuous communication down to the vehicles of the current prices for different facilities for congestion charges. And you can have privacy protections where the onboard computer knows where it's been based on the information it receives from the satellites, and it knows how much you've spent driving around, but unless there's an audit, all the information that goes back to the government is how much you've spent. Any questions?
Questions?
What would be the biggest factor for changes in the share from year to year? What would be the biggest factor?
Chair Burdick, Chair Metzger, the biggest difference, the way highway cost allocation currently is done in Oregon, would derive from changes in what money is being spent on from one biennium to another. As an example, fairly recently, Oregon undertook to spend a lot more money on bridges. And heavy vehicles have a higher responsibility for bridges than for costs on average. So that shifts the responsibility toward heavy vehicles when that happens. Then if all the bridges get taken care of and the focus on spending shifts to something else, you'll see a different effect depending on what the expenditure shifts to. And the reason for that is that we look at the expenditures in the upcoming biennium. It's not a depreciation concept or anything like that. It's just how the money is spent. And when OTIA was passed, the Legislative Revenue Office did a good job of predicting how expenditures on bridges would change the results, and they adjusted the heavy vehicle registration fees and weight mile taxes and flat fees accordingly, and in the subsequent studies, it showed that it worked out well. They got it pretty close to right.
Thank you.
Any more?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at your slide on the flat fee rates and then looking at the testing for revenue neutrality document, I wonder if you might comment on the statement that the adjustments were made based on professional judgment to come to the conclusion that the sand and gravel had underpaid. And I'll declare a conflict of interest. Okay. Having been in the sand and gravel industry and still having interest.
Could you refresh my memory which adjustments were applicable in that calculation?
Well, so two adjustments were made, Mr. Chair. 3% based on 97% reported miles and a 5% based on 95% reported miles. And it's the sensitivity analysis to illustrate the effect of overstated highway miles by firms hauling sand and gravel and using the flat fee method. The conclusion was that there was underpayment.
Senator Morris, this is probably Lorna's. This is the second document that ODOT is presenting, and that's a Lorna's question. Maybe she could help with answering that question.
I don't think so.
Chair Metzger, Chair Burdick, Senator Morris, I believe that's referring to the adjustment for the proportion of reported miles on the flat file fee tax reports that were actually not taxable miles. And it was an issue in the log truck miles as well. So the professional judgment, I believe, was used to reduce the estimate of what those vehicles would have to pay under weight mile taxes, assuming that if they were paying weight mile taxes, they would be reporting, they'd be more careful about reporting only their taxable miles. Those are miles on public roads rather than on construction sites or whatever. So to the extent that those adjustments were made, they made the estimated underpayment smaller.
Yeah. There might be something you might want to have a continued discussion with the charts. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I believe our next presenter will be Ms. Youngs. I don't know if, Mazin, do you have any introduction to that, or we just let her introduce?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't. The only thing I need to say is this is a legal requirement rather than a constitutional requirement. And this is ORS 825482, and the study complies with that.
Good afternoon, members of the Senate, Senator Chair Metzger, Chair Burdick. I'm here before you as Mazin has pointed out to comply with statutory requirements. As you know, there has
under... Could you give your name for the record?
Please? I'm sorry. Lorna Youngs, Deputy Director for the Department of Transportation for Central Services. As you know, under Oregon law, filers can choose to pay either the weight mile tax or to pay a flat fee, which is based essentially on a declared weight and a monthly flat fee at that declared weight. And my understanding that was instituted for the ease of small operations for whom calculating a weight mile tax on their daily operations was burdensome. And the statute requires that every 2 years we examine the flat fee to determine whether or not it is revenue neutral in relationship to the weight mile tax. And so we have in addition to my testimony, we have the study that is done by Dr. Catherine Lawson to examine the weight mile taxes and some of the information that we have from the department and determine whether or not there is revenue neutrality. The question that was asked earlier by Senator Morse regarding was answered essentially correctly by Carl in that what happens when we do the weight mile or the flat fee analysis is that the flat fee filers provide simply monthly mileage, It could be odometer at the beginning of the month and odometer at the end of the month. They may or may not be careful about determining which of those miles were actually on Oregon roads and which of those miles were on sites that are not taxable. As pointed out, that's particularly a problem for the logging industry. And so some professional judgment is used in determining how much mileage should be subtracted from that reported miles in order to determine which would be taxable miles. Does that get at the question that you were answering, Senator Morris?
Yeah, thank you. Anytime we're dealing with numbers, and then it's based on professional judgment, it calls into question how that judgment is arrived at. So that was what was behind my question.
Chair Burdick, Chair Metzger, I believe that the professional judgment is arrived at by consultation with Dr. Lawson and another transportation specialist, the name of which I don't have on my brain at the moment, who has studied the industry rather carefully to get some sense of how to model that. But in the absence of hard data, all economists have to apply some professional judgment. So the results of the study showed that for the wood chip carriers, they are overpaying. They're currently paying $24.62 per hundredweight of their declared weight, and that should be reduced to $13.53 to achieve revenue neutrality. Sand and gravel should be increased, on the other hand. They are currently paying $6.05, and that should be increased to $7.90 per 100 pounds of declared weight. And finally, log carriers should be increased from their current fee of $6.10 to $6.31 per 100 pounds of declared weight in order to achieve revenue neutrality. And that essentially is my report. I would be happy to answer any questions that I am capable of, given that I am not an economist.
Well, even then may not come up with the right answer, right?
But I will provide professional judgment.
There we go. It'll all come out in the wash. Questions for Ms. Youngs? Okay.
Thank you very much.
If we have you up again next.
I am simply here to introduce my esteemed colleague.
Then we'll let you go ahead and do that for efficiency.
Dr. Kavanaugh will be presenting to you the updated forecast. Well, as updated as we currently are, you'll be getting a new one in a few days, and we'll once again be behind. But this is an update of the December revenue forecast as it impacts the highway revenue.
And Mr. Kavanaugh, before you begin, just with Ms. Young's introduction, I know, as she had mentioned, we're going to get some new things very soon. And to the extent that you have knowledge of some of that, you know, that might be helpful to interject as you do your presentation in terms of, you know, trend lines, rather than just having to come back tomorrow and do it all over again.
Okay. Chair Metzger, Madam Chair Burdick, and members of the respective committees, my name is Dave Kavanaugh. I'm a state transportation economist, and I work out at the Financial Services Branch, which is contained in the Central Services Division of the agency. A little bit of a backdrop as to why we're giving the forecast. The department submits to DAS twice a year an other funds revenue forecast, and one component of that, there are a number of other agencies that collect fees and revenues that aren't part of the general fund. ODOT is probably the largest agency in terms of revenues that qualifies as the other funds revenue forecast. We submit to DAS tabular results that go into the report, and those reports get published December the 1st and June the 1st of every year. When we supplied the updated other funds forecast, it was based on our June 2008
forecast. So by December, there's a little bit of a lag there. And as we all remember, the economic turbulence that the economy was being buffeted with in the fall of the year kind of made it moot that we were talking about a June 2008 forecast when we knew that things had deteriorated considerably more by November-December time frame. Well, we presented that forecast with a caveat that we would be updating a new one at the end of the year, which is called the December 2008 forecast. And then we offered the two interim committees at that time that we would update the forecast at their leisure if they would like to hear from us come February. So that's where we are today, is giving an update using the December 2008 forecast. Having said that, the other funds, transportation revenue forecast, are for taxes and fees that are collected statewide in Oregon only. It excludes local option taxes. For example, the gas tax that's charged in Multnomah County at 3 cents a gallon. We don't have that in the other funds forecast. And there are a number of other municipalities that also have local option taxes, namely gas taxes as well, that aren't covered in this forecast. The total amount of gross revenues that we're talking about is on the order of $1.8 to $2 billion per biennium out through the 2013-2015 biennium period. The other fund forecast excludes federal funds, which is a fairly significant resource to the department, but we don't have that in the forecast. So again, it's just taxes and fees that are collected within the state. The numbers that we provide to the Office of Economic Analysis for filing the other funds forecast are gross revenues, and that is kind of a little bit misleading in terms of what are the actual net resources that are available to the department to carry out its mission. There are a number of things that one would net out from gross revenues that would amount to net revenues. There are the collection costs for collecting the fees, there are program costs, and then there are general and administrative costs of running the agency. We also collect revenues that go to other agencies. For example, gas taxes that are used in ATVs go to the State Parks and Recreation Department. So we have a lot of interagency transfers that take money out of the gross collections that reduce what are the net resources available to the agency. There are also dedicated fund transfers within the State Highway Fund that stay within the agency, but they're dedicated to specific programs, like the number of programs in the Transportation Operating Fund. Those are still state fund dollars, but they're dedicated to Public Transit Division, for example, a non-highway application of those monies. Once we net out all these transfers and collection costs and general and administrative costs, then we wind up with about $1.5 billion in resources. Then another major component is the statute requires that we apportion some of the revenues net of these collection costs to the local governments. There are a number of apportionment formulas, but in the net, counties get about $340 million per biennium, and the cities get about $230 million per biennium under the various apportionment formulas. So by the time you net that out, we have a little bit more than $900 million per biennium that are kind of, if you will, net resources available to the State Highway Fund. So you can see that the gross number shrinks considerably from the $1.8 to $2 billion number that we start out with as gross revenues. How do we forecast the transportation revenue numbers? We use pretty much the same type of statistical models that are used in the state economic forecasting model. There are a lot of similarities in how we do that. We also, when we do a forecast, then we take the state economic forecast, which in the one that we'll be discussing today will be linked to the December 2008 forecast. Unfortunately, a week from Friday, we get a new forecast, so we'll be lagging a little bit behind in terms of representing the current economic state of affairs. But we also use the same macro forecast that's used to drive, if you will, the state economic forecast from December of 2008. So there's, if you will, we're kind of joined at the hip using the same macro assumptions, and then we use basically the same employment numbers, employment by sectors, personal income in the state of Oregon, as what's contained in the state economic forecast. The balance of the presentation, of course, is to go ahead and give an overview of what the new forecast looks like. Then I thought I'd use an illustration to show how the forecast model has been tracking, to hopefully give you a little bit more confidence so we have a handle on where we're headed going forward. Then I'll give a summary and then offer a contrast with our June 2008 forecast so you can kind of get an idea of what revenue erosion we're projecting based on where we were just 6 months ago. And then finally, some caveats and qualifications to the forecast, particularly in these turbulent economic times that we're in. We assume certain conditions are going to hold, but right now we don't have much in the way of guarantees that they're going to be in place even 1 month down the road, let alone 6 months or 12 months. What is the composition of our gross state highway fund revenues? We have two representations here. One, revenue by source. When we report the other funds revenue forecast to DAS, we break it into five main components. The largest one, motor fuels taxes, is about $856 million, or 47-48% of the total gross amount. These are the gas taxes that are paid, and these are the diesel fuel taxes that are paid. The next largest component are the weight mile taxes, which are weight distance taxes paid by heavy trucks in excess of 26,000 pounds. That was the topic of a lot of the highway cost allocation study review that you got earlier in this hearing. That represents about 25% of the gross revenues. Then the next largest component are our vehicle license fees. Those are all the registration fees associated with the multitude of vehicles, from light passenger vehicles, of which there are about 3.3 million in the state, all the way from motorcycles and trailers, as well as trucks in the what we call the medium-heavy category, the 10,000-pound to 26,000-pound weight class. Those are collected by the Department of Drivers and Motor Vehicles. And then there's the heavy trucks registration fee income that's also contained in that for the trucks in excess of 26,000 pounds. That component represents about 20% of the gross revenues. The final two are considerably smaller, as you can see, the driver's license fees. Those include not only non-commercial drivers, but also commercial driver's licenses and testing that we can go through, hazardous materials testing and components of that sort. And then the final aspect are the other transportation license and fees. Those are predominantly made up of titles and title transactions and title duplications for vehicles for ownership, as well as other motor vehicles. And it also includes some compliance and regulatory functions that the agency administers, for example, regulating dealers and regulating records and salvage yard operators. Another way of classifying the revenues is how they vary with the use of the state highway system, and that's what I call revenue by type. And there's basically two types of revenues. Use taxes, those are revenues that vary by how the system is actually used, how intensely it's used. Those are comprised of the fuel taxes that you might expect. More driving, more gasoline consumption, more gasoline tax. More freight shipment, more weight mile tax, so those go up with economic activity, so they vary with usage. The other component, the vehicle and driver and other fees, those are fixed fee components. Those fees don't vary by how much you actually use the system, okay? So what we have here is a representation of if you impose costs on the system by using it, then you pay those costs, and that appeals to our sense of equity in terms of fee structures, if you will, rate structures. And what we have are use taxes comprise about 72% of our gross revenues, and the fixed fee taxes, which are basically access charges to the system. It doesn't have any, those rates don't change by how much you actually use the system. It just gives you the right to drive your car out onto a public highway. Okay? You may elect not to drive it out there, but you still have to pay that vehicle registration fee or that fixed fee registration, and those represent about 28% of the cost. Looking at the components of the forecast for the December 2008 model solution, historically, fuel tax revenues, diesel and gas tax, came in a little bit lower in calendar year 2008 than they were in 2007, about 3.5%. That's not as extreme as other states experienced, or even nationwide. And the explanation for that is probably due to HB 2210 that was passed in the 07 session that had the ethanol blending requirement. In a kind of a phased-in implementation of 2210, retailers had to go ahead and blend up to or blend at least 10% ethanol into gasoline. The fuel efficiency of light vehicles would drop because of that, just because the energy content in that blend is a little bit less than it would be in 100% gasoline. So if people drive the same amount of miles, if you will, they require a little bit more of this ethanol blend gasoline to go ahead and accomplish that distance. So they would wind up buying a little bit more gasoline. This was phased in three parts across the state in 2008. In January, the northwest counties of the state, I think there were five or six of the northwest counties, phased it in. Then the next phase was in the southwestern part of the state in April. And then east of the Cascades, the final phase in went into effect in mid-September. So it was kind of dribbled in a little bit. Once we get into an annual run rate, if you will, more than likely the effects will be a little bit more than what we saw in 2008 in terms of having a little bit more fuel consumption because of the blending.
Can I ask a question about that? On that topic, did you you're looking at it from a revenue standpoint, but you had to have some calculation to make, you know, that statement. Do you have a figure on a basis when you say greater consumption in order to go to the same amount of miles, what that figure might be based on when that transition took place and in the areas that it did take place?
Yes, Chair Metzger, Madam Chair Burdick, what we did was we don't know exactly how it's going to affect fuel efficiency, because driving habits could affect it too. People might be a little bit more sensitive to just to the fact that they have ethanol. But what we did was we looked at a couple of cases where suppose the fuel efficiency based on the energy content of the blend was 2% less energy. So then I went ahead and took a 2% case, a 4% case, and a 10% case, all the way up to a 10% case of a loss of fuel efficiency. And then I went ahead and took that, took out the diesel portion, because diesel wasn't being blended. Gasoline is about in excess of 90% of all the motor fuels that are sold. So then I took out the diesel fuel component and applied the adjustment to say, okay, in the northwest part of the state, I know it's only going to be in effect for 11 and a half months of calendar year 2008. I went ahead and took basically a kind of a pro rata share of vehicle registrations in kind of a rough sense, in kind of a single digit sense, if you will, to say that, okay, statewide, what's going on in the northwest part of the state is going to lower this much consumption. And then I went ahead and did the same thing when the phase-in went into effect in southwest Oregon, saying that, okay, we get a little bit more of the population on the west side coming in. And I varied this according to those four cases, 2% loss of efficiency, 4%, because I don't know exactly what it's going to be. The scientific community has said anywhere from 1.5% to 2% up to as much as 10%. So that's where I kind of got my start. And then I ran that in the model combined with the Portland metro area counties, if you will, that started in January. And what you're able to do once it's phased in the eastern part of the state, then it's basically about a 2% loss of fuel efficiency statewide once it kicks in. But yeah, I had to kind of ramp it up, if you will, from January and April to a statewide implementation. And what happens is I have to apply that factor to all fuels. So I take out the diesel portion, and what it nets out to be is about 1.8% loss of fuel efficiency. So that kind of goes into the models to say, okay, we think we're going to sell this much fuel without ethanol. And then I go ahead and I put in that little model on the blending application to go ahead and bump up the actual gallons that are sold by about 1.8% once we go into a full statewide implementation.
Okay. Mr. Chair. Well, it'll be interesting to see as we go through full and you get closer to seeing the actual consumption. I think everybody would be really curious to see, you know, what the net-net is of consumption for the same VNT of, you know, whatever the control group type vehicle might be as to... I mean, that's just kind of an issue with, since we've moved to that. There's a lot of questions about are we burning more fossil fuel to get this, to, you know, despite the blending because of the extra consumption that might. So it'll be interesting to see as you continue to model that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair Burdick. One thing that's nice is right now it's all on kind of a perspective basis because we haven't been accumulating historical data. But as I've indicated, I think in the November hearings, once we get into spring, summer of next year, then I'll start to have some historical data to go ahead and compare that to. And then hopefully, if it's a big enough blimp, that statistically we might be able to measure that and go ahead and compare it to our deterministic model that I probably didn't do a very good job describing, but hopefully you got a little bit of a sense of the kind of the care that we applied to go ahead and develop that adjustment for 2210 in lieu of knowing what was really going to happen. The December 2008 forecast is represented in Figure 2 by the solid heavy blue line. Shows that in and these are on a fiscal these are on a fiscal year basis in contrast to that historical comparison that was calendar year. It shows that there's a fairly considerable blip in motor fuel revenues in FY 2009, about a minus 3% drop, which is somewhat considerable. And then coming out of this economic contraction, we get back up on to kind of a growth rate of about 2.4% going forward out to the end of the forecast horizon. And it looks like probably in about FY10, FY11, we kind of recover back to where our revenue levels were before we went into recession. Comparing our current forecast with the prior forecast, the little black dashed line is our view of the world as of December 2007, and you can see that it kind of showed a very sustained upward trend. That was obviously because the economic backdrop that we were using to do the forecast didn't have any kind of a recession or downturn coming up, and so obviously the business cycle was missed, and that caused the December 07 forecast to be considerably over target. The green line is our prior forecast from last summer, the June 2008 forecast. You can see that things kind of flattened out a little bit over the three-year period, but we didn't really have much of a recession baked in, if you will, into the macro forecast or the state economic forecast. So it basically kind of was lethargic and stayed flat and then started to resume its normal growth in the out years after 2010. An interesting question that's being posed is that after we experienced gas prices of $2.25, $2.30 last summer, is there maybe a little bit of a panacea in store for the state highway fund if gasoline prices are now down to less than $2 a gallon? In fact, I think they fell as low as $1.65 last December. The answer to that is it's a very muted impact. We don't expect the people just to go out and buy more gasoline because it's $2 a gallon cheaper than it was in the summer, and that's because gasoline consumption is a derived demand. It's not used for providing satisfaction directly, like going to a movie theater or going out for dinner or buying a meal. It's bought as an intermediate input into satisfying other activities, going to work, going to school, going to leisure and hospitality types of events. So people aren't going to go ahead and just buy more gas now just because it feels good. They're going to buy more gas because their household budgets have a little bit more slack into them. They'll start going and enjoying more meals out, and to be able to go ahead and enjoy that ultimate consumption, they have to presumably drive to it, and that will cause gasoline demand to go up. So it's the indirect effect of this drop in gasoline prices that will stimulate business activity, it will stimulate travel demands, and that will cause people to use more gasoline, and we'll see that in increased gasoline sales. The other component of our user tax is the weight mile component from heavy trucks. Historically, last year in 2008, they were down considerably, about 6.1% from the prior year. The current forecast, again, is highlighted in the solid blue line in Figure 3. You can see that weight mile taxes were quite flat during the 2006 to 2008 time frame, and this also kind of attests to the impact of prices versus economic activity. We've had high gasoline prices and high diesel prices in particular, the fuel that's used to power these kinds of rigs. We've had those since somewhat sustained since 2004, 2005, but going into 2006 and 2007, we still had high diesel prices, but our weight mile taxes weren't really going down. They weren't that sensitive to it. Why? Because there was a lot of freight being shipped. You probably saw the headlines on the Oregonian this morning that showed that Oregon's exports in 2008 were up 17% year over year to an all-time record of $19.4 billion, a phenomenal number. But that was going on in 2008. It's that freight shipment that's causing weight mile taxes to go ahead and kind of trump the price effects of high gasoline. So again, it's economic activity driven that really causes weight mile taxes, as gasoline taxes and diesel taxes, to move a lot and not so much price. The drop off in weight mile taxes is fairly prominent. I think it's about 5% in FY, 5.8% in the FY09 time frame. Then it comes back, as we assume in our macro backdrop and in the state forecast, that the economy starts to pick up steam in the latter half of 2009 and continues to gain momentum in early 2010 and going forward from there. The growth rate is still a little bit more muted, but it's about 3% on average over the forecast horizon. Comparison with what we've been doing in our forecast the past year, the dashed line is again the December 07 forecast. No recession, no decline in weight mile revenues. The green line is the June 2008 forecast. We didn't have much of an economic downturn at that time in the baked into the forecast, and so that shows a very flat pattern, and then resuming growth as we hopefully started to pick up steam in the 2011 time frame. But obviously the macro backdrop has deteriorated considerably. Last quarter, the fourth quarter of 2008, and this quarter are kind of expected, the consensus forecast, to be the depths of the downturn, if you will. The condition of the trucking industry, there have been considerable job losses, a lot of bankruptcies and closures, particularly of small independent firms. It's kind of unfortunate. The industry weathered the high diesel prices in 2004 all the way through 2008 and managed to grow, so to speak. But then all of a sudden, when prices dropped by the fall, a considerable number, and they could probably feel like they could have a sense of relief, then all of a sudden the economy contracted considerably, and freight demand and freight shipments dropped off a lot, and that's caused the whole industry to really go into the doldrums. The final part of the other funds forecast are the fixed fee revenues. Those are the vehicle and driver fees, which include the fixed fees for heavy trucks as well as for light passenger vehicles. For the year 2008, they were off by about 5.8% from the prior year. Fairly sensitive to conditions. Ordinarily, driver and vehicle fees are a little bit more stable than the user tax income that we get. Our December outlook has changed, as you can see, compared to June 2008. The solid blue line is everywhere kind of below and parallel with what we were forecasting in June of 2008. A couple things that are helping drive this downturn are linked to the economy. As you know, the big three auto manufacturers are having some of the worst years in auto sales on record, and if there are fewer new cars being sold, then in Oregon we're getting few new car titles being issued. We're getting less four-year vehicle registration that new cars have to pay, and so our fixed fee revenues, which are again a little bit more stable than the user tax revenues, but when it's tied to durable goods consumptions like new cars, then we're starting to see a little bit more sensitivity, much more than we ordinarily would.
Does this also include drivers' license fees?
Chairman Metzger and Madam Chair Burdick, yes, it includes new cars, it includes registration renewals, driver's licenses, titles.
I was just wondering if, since we enacted the new driver's license fee, now it's been about a year, do you have any separate analysis about what the percentage increase or decrease in just driver's license fees have been based on historical records as well? I mean, we can see the composite here, but I was curious about driver's license.
Yes.
Have we seen a drop in that?
Chair Metzger and Chair Burdick, yes, we have that in the model, the effects of Senate Bill 1080 in there. I don't have the number right off my head. We can get that for you if you're interested in that selected component of the revenue forecast.
Yeah, I think it would just be curious to see what impact. We've heard about impacts prior to the bill, and I was just curious to see what the actual has been.
I recall hearing the number, Chair Metzger. I recall hearing the number, but it's a little bit elusive right now. But so rather than take a guess, I think I know what it is, but I think we'll get back to you with a little more precision.
Chair Metzger, the most pronounced impact has been on the ID card fee, which is down approximately 30%. Driver license issuances are down as well, and a report was prepared by the administrator of the DMV on the impacts of Senate Bill 1080, and we'd be more than happy to share that with you.
Thank you.
Okay, that's kind of a summary of the components of the forecast. An example of how well the forecasting model is tracking is in Figure 5 on the next slide. What I've done here is kind of juxtapose three different forecasts for the fuel tax component of the model. The fuel tax is only, of course, that's 48-49% of all the gross revenues, so it's fairly substantial. The little dashed blue line in the chart is what we were forecasting in December 2007 out through November of 2008. And you can see that broadly it kind of captures the swings and the behavior of the black triangle, which are the actual values that were subsequently realized, but it's still systematically overpredicted, partly because we didn't have a real good handle on the course of the economy, and the macro backdrop was a little more sanguine about the prospects for the economy than what actually transpired. If we go into our June 2008 forecast, that's the red dashed line and a little hollowed out triangles. That's effective starting April of last spring. And it too obviously captures the pattern of the actuals a little bit. It's a little bit closer, but it still systematically overpredicts slightly. And ordinarily, we know that we're not always going to be right on, but if sometimes we overpredict 1 month and then underpredict the next month, they'll average out on an annual basis so that we would be doing pretty well on an aggregate fiscal year basis. But for those two examples, largely because the macro backdrop overstated the condition of the economy that wound up in actuality being worse than we thought. Our job growth, for example, in the state started to go way down in the second quarter of 2008, just about the time we did that June forecast. And so that wasn't in our set of assumptions when all of a sudden the labor markets started to deteriorate. The December 2008 forecast is the golden one. I don't know if there's any symbolism there or not, but it's the gold one. And it starts in the fall of 2008, and it's kind of calibrated to those actual values. And hopefully that means that going forward with that calibration and the a little bit better assessment of the economic contraction that we have in the macro backdrop will enable us to track a little bit more accurately than what we did in the 2007 forecast. Now, the model has its own error structure, if you will, but the major source of a forecast error is the fact is that you don't know exactly how the economy is going to unfold. Okay, so it's the macro backdrop and errors there or mistakes in the forecast that really drive the large forecast errors that we have in our revenue model.
by about probably a ratio of 9 to 1 or 10 to 1.
In summary, as I've kind of probably dwelled on at length, the economic downturn has really had a major impact on our use tax revenues and as well, uncharacteristically, on our fee-based revenues. Under current law, we haven't put in, for example, any of the revenue effects from HB 2120, the Job and Transportation Act, into the forecast. We would do that once that becomes law and we're given an implementation date. So this is prior to any major transportation funding initiative in this present session. Going forward, we're projecting about 2.5% annual average growth out through FY15 under current fees and taxes. Unfortunately, our construction cost budgets are going up at rates a little bit higher than that. So in constant dollar terms, our purchasing power is being eroded just because of inflation and revenues growing at rates a little bit less than inflation. As you can see from the June 2008 forecast, which is a little dashed trajectory there, if you will, that the gap continues to widen out over the forecast period. I prepared a chart that examines the erosion in a little bit more detail from our prior forecast, and you can see that in FY09 it's somewhat sizable, about $31 or $32 million in revenue erosion from our June 2008 forecast. Not quite as bad in FY10, but then because this economy and the forecast is for a little bit lower, more lackluster growth, and we're not going to gain traction and get back on our real balanced growth path until a little bit later, we see that the erosion starts to really grow out over the forecast horizon. All told, by the time we take in those 7 years of revenue gaps, if you will, that amounts to about $300 million cumulatively that we don't have to spend that we thought we had back in June of 2008 to spend over that 7 year period. June 2008 by itself had some revenue erosion, so you can see that the revenue picture is turning a little bit more grim than what we were definitely projecting a year ago in 2007. Concerns in the outlook, not so much that obviously we're in a recession or its depth, but I think it's probably kind of the duration and how we get out of it. There are a couple of things there. The federal stimulus package is still being put together. It could possibly be signed as early as next week, but its implementation is uncertain, and its effects on stimulating the economy are a little bit uncertain. The macro forecast that we use has a placeholder stimulus package kind of baked into it a little bit that has it spread out over 2 years, which is a fairly reasonable representation, I think, that some of these programs, like the infrastructure spending part, aren't going to hit the pavement running immediately, that they'll be distributed over time. So the macro backdrop does have some stimulus assumptions in it on the order of the magnitude of the $800 billion that we're looking at from Congress today. So that's in there, but how it actually plays out and the interdependencies unfold could mean that we may not gain our traction economically for a number of quarters beyond what we think we have in the macro forecast right now. So that's the biggest source of uncertainty. Hopefully the uncertainty about how deep the recession will be will be answered with this quarter's growth numbers. Other sources of uncertainty, unfortunately, we found out rather rudely that all the economies are still coupled to one another. There isn't a decoupling that has gone on like a lot of Pollyannas thought that there might be, and that might cause one economy to be going well in one part of the globe and another economy not to be going quite as well, and that they would even out so it would minimize the contraction. Most of the economies, even China's, may have real growth, but their real growth will be at such a low rate that they'll still have rising unemployment in the cities. So that picture there kind of complicates things. Things aren't going to get better until we get our financial institutions back to better health, and that is probably going to take a little bit longer, given that we've been working on it since August of 2007, so we have a little ways more to go there. How that unfolds will affect our macro outlook, and that also spills over into the state economic outlook. Concurrent with our revenue forecast, we also do a construction cost trends analysis and construction cost trends forecast for materials only, not counting diesel fuel and not counting labor. It looks like the commodity price spikes that we went through in 2007 and the first part of 2008 are behind us, and cost escalation will get back down into a little bit more manageable level of around 2-3% per year. Still probably about the same or slightly more than what our revenue growth is under current law. And then the final component, our labor costs, have been fairly muted and reasonably well-behaved. We haven't had spikes like what we've had in diesel fuel and what we've had in steel prices or in asphalt prices. So those are expected to be fairly well-contained. So that is the extent of my my update, and I'd be happy to answer any additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cavanaugh. Questions? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Cavanaugh, I'm drawn to the optimism of the December 8th forecast, which indicates by your slides that we have reached the bottom now and we're starting to trend back. If you were in your best informed judgment, and I realize we're coming up next week, are we at the bottom?
Well, Chair Metzger, Chair Burdick, Senator Morse, the macro service does, a good job forecasting one or two quarters out, but frankly, their guess is probably as good as anybody's else beyond that. I mean, sure, the model is being run. And so I say that, meaning that I think they have a pretty good handle on where we are in the first quarter, and this may be the worst quarter in this contraction. But then thereafter, the model, and our models are probably as guilty of it as anybody else's, kind of assume things work like a well-defined watch, a well-run engine, that things are going to run smoothly, and recoveries just don't quite work that way. All the sectors just don't start going ahead and striking a similar chord and working together and propel us out of a contraction. Some sectors will lag. For example, housing is still in the doldrums, and it'll probably continue to be that way. But a lot of it has to do with the balance sheets of these financial institutions. I personally think it's going to be at least a year before we have some semblance of stability in the balance sheets of financial institutions. I don't see things working like a well-machined clock a quarter or two out from here. So I kind of echo your skepticism, but I take the macro model as given, as does Tom Petoskey when he's doing the state economic forecast, and we can go ahead and lend a little bit of professional judgment, if you will, to the near-term numbers. But beyond that, we just have to go ahead and assume that, okay, the models have a good representation of the economic structure, and we'll go ahead and let the models run. And that's what the Global Insights has done. They basically assume that we get through the next quarter or two, and then we kind of get back up to a reasonable growth path. Well, that assumes that everything works extremely well and that markets all equilibrate. But we know that there's certain markets like housing that are hard assets. They don't equilibrate anywhere near as fast as the market for bread or as fast as the market for milk. So you have all these different types of commodities in different markets. They don't all equilibrate at the same speed. So I share your skepticism. I think it's probably going to be a bumpy recovery. We had a bumpy recovery coming out of the 90-91 recession nationwide as well as in Oregon, and that financial-induced contraction it wasn't anywhere near as severe as what we're going through now. So, and that was a slow recovery until 1996. That took 4 or 5 years before we got through that cycle. Of course, it was complicated with a little bit of stringent monetary policy by the Fed in 95 because they got nervous. They thought inflation was going to take off. So there are policy mistakes that can intervene and kind of throw a wrench into the machinery.
This would be a long discussion, and I'll not pursue it, but I have the sense that Global Insight does not differentiate between kind of the normal economic-driven recessions and financial crises-driven recessions. And I refer specifically to a study of the history of nations that have been influenced by financial crises and the duration and depths of recessions and depressions. And Dr. Rogoff from Harvard authored a study and presented that in January, which draws a much different conclusion than what I see coming out of Global Insight.
Chair Metzger, Chair Burdick, Senator Morse. I haven't seen that study. It sounds like an interesting one. I recognize the name, and he's a very well-known economist. The only way Global Insights kind of captures the issues that he brings up in that kind of a paper or theme is they think that they can capture that in the financial data that goes ahead and they use to estimate the model, but it probably doesn't quite do it adequately or represent the severity or the extreme situation that it's in. So in that case, the Global Insights model might be understating those effects.
Let's hope it gets better. I want to be recognition of everybody's time at the moment, 3 o'clock for their other committees. I thank you very much for your presentations, and we hope that things get better soon rather than later, and we just don't know. You're right, Senator Morris. It's very scary, but I guess we do the best we can with what we got. So I'm going to close the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation.
Senate Finance and Revenue is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.